Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Oh, welcome to a great Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Feeling more like a typical Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Yeah, look, folks, I just have to comment. I don't know if you've, and I know Greg down there and folks on Fowl River down around the in the wetlands, they had noticed it. But if you're in town and you've been plagued by Asian tiger mosquitoes, you may not know what they are, but mostly they are Asian tiger mosquitoes in town. If they just drive you crazy all the time, I hope you stop to notice that they ain't out there. Man, I've been sitting on the porch. You know what? I rolled my pants legs up. I just rolled my pants legs up, pulled my socks down, and said, "Hey, guys, go at it." Nothing happened. It's crazy. It's weird. It's weird. So I think it was that dry spell, that little bit of a dry spell, you know, when the there's a little bit of a sign when you see the when you see the resurrection fern browning out, which it was. I noticed on all the limbs. Oh boy, early last week, it was just browned out everywhere. When your potted plants start to die, that's a good sign that it's getting dry. Huh? Well, it got dry. People have had great luck with their tomatoes as a result of that. Beautiful tomato weather. Great tomato weather. And how do I? Well, I can see because people are sending me pictures of their tomatoes. They look really good. There's some things that can go wrong now. Let's talk about those. We'll talk about them now. I want you to watch out for your tomatoes because they are beginning to ripen. And June is this critical time. You know, it'd be better if we could get our tomatoes to start ripening in May. It's very hard to do that. If we were picking fruit in the middle of May, that would be ideal. I'd say we had the ideal tomato season. It's harder to do that unless you've got some very early tomato varieties. But I know a lot of people, Greg sent me pictures of his German Johnson, which is not a or our German Queen, which is not a fast tomato. It's a slow tomato. And it's going to ripen slowly. It's a beautiful thing. And so, you know, we got to watch them here very carefully. And so we need to talk about what can happen, what can go wrong. The rains are coming, and that has made some things easier. It'll make some things harder. We're going to begin to get some of the tomato diseases and other problems in the garden that we have been avoiding, like the mosquitoes. We've been avoiding these. They're going to start showing up now. We need to talk about that this morning. So feel free to give me a call if you're worried about your tomatoes, if you're worried about anything else. Let me tell you something else that we've kind of lucked through a little bit. And, you know, we can't fix a lot of things. John Olive and I try to help in the best way we can. John is with Auburn University. And I said to John last year, I said, John, you know, we need to try. It is getting so frustrating to grow basil because we're getting this new downy mildew disease. It's really just and I love basil. We got to do something about it. Let's try these new varieties. Let's trial them. John has been doing that. We've got some new varieties of basil that are apparently going to be pretty resistant to the downy mildew, the basil downy mildew. That has been affecting our basil and really just killing basil harvest here along the Gulf Coast and throughout much of the country. We're working on that. We're trying to figure it out. John did some great trials this year with several of the varieties I can't get hold of, but John did some of those trials. I did some trials on some other varieties that I can get hold of from seed. And we've been evaluating that and looking at it so far. I mean, it's a preliminary kind of thing, but we feel pretty optimistic that we may be able to grow basil again. The big question is, and John and I are both asking this, and we're getting to the point where we're about ready to harvest. Does it taste like the basil people are familiar with? Or does it have a different taste? Because these new varieties have different species that have been incorporated into them. And I'm actually growing some of the straight species that have been incorporated into these just to see how they compare for taste. So it's been an interesting year for us with the basil. We're working on it. I'd love to hear this morning from you about your basil. If you don't mind, tell us how it's done so far. If you've been noticing some browning around the leaf edges, or just generally just collapse of plants, if you turn the leaves upside down and there's these little black sort of, it looks like you hadn't shaved in a day or two. If you're a guy, well, if you're a girl too, I guess, it kind of looks like you hadn't shaved in a day or two. Underneath that basil leaf, and if you're seeing that, let us know about it. Let me know about it. If your basil's just doing just fine, you let me know. Tell me where you got it, what kind of basil it is. We'd love to know that, because we're trying to figure out. Basil is one of the South's great vegetables. Everybody talks about it being a spice. It's a vegetable, folks. It's a vegetable. We use it like a vegetable. It is one of our great summer greens, and I would hate to miss it. So let's talk about that and figure out how to do that. But be sure to let us know how your basil's doing this morning. Lots of other great things to talk about this morning, but I want to get back to a subject that we have introduced over the past several weeks, and I can't let it die, and here's why. I can't let it die because I'm from Alabama and Mississippi, a little bit of both. I'm from that part of those parts of Mississippi and Alabama where it can be hard to tell the difference, if you know what I mean. And it's right on the borderlands. Of Alabama, Mississippi. I've kind of always grown up in these rural areas. I've lived in rural areas a lot of my life. I spent a lot of my time working in rural areas, trying to find work in rural areas of Alabama and Mississippi. And I've spent a lot of time in the fields. It's an interesting thing. It's for various reasons. Helping real farmers. Helping people who wanted to be farmers, like my dad. helping them understand what's going on and learning from them. Learning from the land, learning from them. And a lot of what I know about gardening, I will tell you, came from my experience being out in the fields where people did real agriculture. People tried to make money growing what they grew, whether it was small crops or big crops or blueberries or fruit trees. All of these things are part of my background. So it's something I can't quite get rid of. You know, here's the interesting thing. Those rural areas where I grew up, those rural areas where I was born, they ain't doing so well. There are a few people who are doing well, and there are people who retire to those communities, and they bring their money with them, and they have their influence there, and they kind of try to relive what it was like. But you know, life in these communities, the stores are gone. The stores that these communities grew up with are gone. The people are moving out. There's no jobs. You can find a job at the Dollar General if you're lucky. But there's just not much in the way of jobs in those places. And what happened? You'd think, what about the farms? Well, the farms aren't providing jobs anymore. There is a policy in the United States that is designed to reduce the number of jobs available in rural areas. That is what it is designed to do. It's just that simple. There are many agricultural policies that are designed to reduce because we have decided that it's better to pay for a machine than to pay a person to do work. This is a problem all over, but it's become a particular problem in rural areas. Now, if you decide that efficiency is the only thing that matters, efficiency in agriculture, then that's okay. And if you don't care about the rural areas and people having jobs and those areas, those towns surviving, that's okay. I mean, that's all right. That's, you know, you then you got one farmer farming a 5,000 acres, 10,000 acres. He's got the equivalent of 6 or 7 Ferraris in his garage, because that's what these machines cost. These big machines that he uses to manage the fields. But, you know, what about the rural areas? What about those communities? What about those people? What happens to them? How do we deal with that? And so I've been thinking a lot about that. How do we have, is agriculture play any role at all in any of this? In case you're wondering, I may talk a little bit about that this morning when we come back, but we're also going to talk about your garden. We'll be back.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right round all the 7 oceans, drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's as sweet. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey. Just like honey, baby.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. I got lots of information here from different folks this morning. Taxman says small farm is over. You know, it may be, but we're going to talk a little bit about it. You know, there's evidence that it may not be, and there's some things that have been happening. One of the things that's happening is that one of the ways that we paid for ever more expensive equipment, you know, when equipment's quit being as costly as a Cadillac and then became as expensive as a Ferrari and as a Rolls Royce, one of the ways we paid for this escalating price of equipment was to quit hiring people. So the machines replace people. But at this point, you can't quit hiring people because there's no more people to hire, but the cost of the machinery continues to escalate. And a lot of the costs of production continue to escalate. So it gets to be harder and harder. And the model that we have now may not work. You know, if the small farm is over, probably small communities are over too. We probably just need to say, okay, let's pull it all in, folks. Let's just give up on these little small towns. We don't need them. Let's just all pull back in and let's all live in cities or in the suburbs around cities or in the exurbs around the suburbs around cities. And that's what's happening. That is certainly what's happening. There's probably some dangers in that, and there's probably some things that are unnecessary in that too. So it's an interesting problem. But Taxman tells me his Chinese plums are doing real well. Chinese plums the same as loquats, the same as Japanese plums. Am I right, Taxman? All those things doing really well. Hey, Rusty, I just want to say we got to talk about that little plant that's come up. I can't tell. It's definitely a sumac. I just need to figure out which sumac it is. Given the fact that it's near water and where you are, it makes me worry just a little bit that it could be poison sumac. I'm going to be thinking about it. I'm going to be looking at it. I'd tell you to pull a sample of it and pick it and let me see it a little closer. But you know what? If it's poison sumac, it may not be something you want to do. So we'll figure it out. Hey, Jill, thanks for holding on. I'm listening. What's up? Jill. Hey.
Let's put her on hold in case she steps.
Yeah,
away.
I think I may have tested Jill's patience there. Hey, Jason, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, good morning, Bill. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. First and foremost, last week, Nielsen sent me a diary to do a radio survey, and I want you to know you got credit for the 9 a.m. to 11 o'clock time slot for my radio.
That's very nice.
Hey, he's on again later Sunday night, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
What is it, 7 to 9?
7 to 9. We do a repeat.
So last year I bought 2 milkweeds.
Yes,
sir. And I ended up late in the fall getting tons of monarchs, and they just mowed both milkweeds to the stem. So I was able to collect the seed pods and put them in the refrigerator, and I've got them tons of seed, tons of little milkweeds now going.
Yeah.
And it's against the privacy fence, so I have 2 questions. You know, a buddy of mine does milkweed next to his house, and they cocoon up on the eave of his house. So on the top of my privacy fence, have you ever heard of, like, building, like, a ledge so they would cocoon up on the ledge? And also, we plant zinnias and just wildflowers, but is there a better nectar local plant to be planting for the monarchs? Do you know?
Wow. So all great questions. You know, a lot of the best wildflowers to plant for butterflies are the flowers that haven't been hybridized. Let's talk about that real quickly. The hybridization removes a lot of the floral nectaries because people don't use floral nectaries, if you see what I'm saying. So just as an accident of breeding, we tend to de-emphasize the very qualities that a butterfly needs when seeking out a plant. So look for the most basic wildflowers you can, not for the fanciest, not for the biggest, don't look for double flowered versions of anything. Definitely don't go for double flowered zinnias because they've lost almost all their nectaries. They've been converted into petals. And a lot of the flower parts have been converted into petals, and it just doesn't work. So my basic advice is, yeah, avoid the fancy plant. The fancy plants,
okay,
and just go with the straight versions of plants. There are composites are always great, and so let's just talk about composites generally. A composite is a plant like a sunflower, or a daisy, or an aster, or a liatris, or lots of other plants that have multiple little teeny tiny flowers in a single head. So if you look at a sunflower, what you see is when you see one sunflower, but actually one sunflower, that big golden-looking, sun-looking thing, actually is composed of many little flowers in that head. And that's why you see all those different seeds in there when it's mature. So that's a composite flower. So the composites are really good at having nectaries. They're really good at supplying bees and butterflies and lots of other things. And most of the composites, they're almost all designed for butterflies really well. They don't have deep nectaries. They're all really good. There are a lot of wild composites. So when you find a wild composite like a Coreopsis or a Biden's, or something like that, something they called a wild marigold, they're all really good for butterflies. So those are great too. But my chief advice to you is don't go for the fancy plants. Go for the simplest, most basic, close to the original version plants you can find if you want good nectaries. Would it be great to make a ledge? I think that's a great idea. You know, I really haven't thought about that, and I haven't thought about it a lot, but it does make perfect sense.
And well, I've just seen that my buddy's house. He showed me pictures. Well, they just climb up the side of his house, and they crystallize up on the eave of his house. Just
hundreds
of them, it looks like.
Yeah, yeah. So they're out of the rain. So make a little ledge, sort of like a bat ledge. And you might, if it's too sophisticated, you might attract bats who might eat the butterflies when they emerge. But just a little bit of a ledge that protects them from rain, I think they would really appreciate that.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, good to hear from you, Jason. Thanks.
All right, thank you. All right.
Yeah. Carol, did we just miss you going and coming? Are you there? You are.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am dandy. My tomatoes are giving me a bumper crop.
Good. You still there? Yeah.
And but my issue is at the end of the drought, last week, I dug holes for blueberries and blackberries. And in a plant bed that's on an incline, and the soil has stratas of red pan, and I filled them with water to check out the drainage, and only the one at the bottom drained normally. The rest took 7 hours to drain. And after the rains, the holes are still holding water, so should I replace the soil?
Tell me, Carol, you're in Bay Minette. Sounds like you live on the edge of a pitcher, what used to be a pitcher plant bog or something similar. What happens is that there's a clay lens that gets to be very hard and very dense. Tell me, are you out in the country from Bay Minette, or is this a...
I'm in town.
You're in town. Do you feel, are you on a slope? Are you in a... is it a slope that holes are? Yeah. So there's a good chance it's a pitcher plant bog. There's a small chance, and if it is, it can be very difficult because that means there's a natural hard pan, which is a dense layer of compacted soil that allows things to pool on top. And normally that would have been a pitcher plant bog, which would have been typical for Bay Minette originally. But of course, we've wiped out what probably drained the things that made it a pitcher plant bog. But you still haven't dealt with the clay lens problem.
There is a lot of woods, and originally which was cleared out from homes.
Yeah, and do you? I'm sure. And those woods can come in on a pitcher plant bog. They may not be. They may be kind of short, stubby trees. But let's
longleaf pine and oaks.
Yep.
And my other beds and plants are doing fine.
Yeah. So I just think you have a clay lens there. It could be compacted soil. Here's what I do. I live in downtown Mobile, or Midtown Mobile. There were probably lots of pitcher plant bogs where I lived at one time or something like it. Pine flat woods, not the live oaks we see now, but more typical, more like what you saw around Bay Minette. So what happens in my area is that the drainage is very poor on those soils. So oftentimes, when particularly during winter and spring and during wet times during summer, the water table will be so high that it's almost like having a hard pan. I can't grow anything because the water is so close to the surface and it will actually kill plants. So what I've had to do is rather than dig down when I'm working with that area is I build up. I just build up with organic matter and build big beds of organic matter, and it's been very useful. Just having 6 extra inches of topsoil on top is usually enough to grow plants very well. And so how do I do that? I'll take woody debris, small limbs, anything I cut, and I'll make a pile of it. And I'll let it rot for a year. And then in a year or two, I can come back and I'll have a nice bed of organic matter there, and I can grow things in it. So it's that's how I deal with it.
I am doing that in areas, but now, what am I going to do now with my berries?
With your berries?
Yes.
Yeah, the ones that aren't doing so well, you mean?
I haven't gotten them in the ground yet. I'm waiting to find out from you what to do.
Oh, I see. So you haven't got them in the ground. I see what you're saying. I misunderstood what you were saying earlier. Well, you probably need to find another place because that's not the place to put them unless you can build it up with organic matter. There is a quick way you can do it. If you can find pine bark, each piece no bigger than your fingernail. Some people have heard me say this so much, they repeat it to me like it's a joke, but it's not a joke. It's the thing that works. Pine bark can work very well. If you can build a bed with pine bark and build it up about 6 inches, 7-8 inches, and then plant your berries right into that pine bark. Don't try to dig it in. Just plant them right into that pine bark. They may do okay. It'll take a lot of pine bark, but that's one.
I dug the holes 12 inches deep, but I'm worried about water flowing from one hole to the other. So I made a trench, and I thought if I filled that trench in with different soil or pine bark or whatever, then I could plant them in there.
I wouldn't plant in a trench in a soil like that. You want to plant above ground.
Okay.
It sounds like you have a very high water table. You have a perched water table. And that perched water table means that you're playing with fire if you dig down.
Even though the ground was very hard and dry, you still think I have a high water table?
Well, it's going to perch. Yes, you're creating it. Let's look at it another way. You're going to create a bathtub. You see what I'm saying?
Okay, it's at the top of the incline, almost. So I'll have a backup?
Well, you can. A lot of times, if the clay is very thick, when you dig down into the clay, you've created a little bathtub in that clay that will hold water and that won't drain rapidly. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so that's the problem, and that sounds like what's happened. And it sounds like that was a clay lens that's since been drained, and that clay lens held water and probably had a pitcher plant bog or something on top of it where the water flowed through it. But that was on top of that clay. So when you dig down into the clay, all you do is you create a little wetland. For commercial blueberries, for blueberries like you have, you definitely want to raise the soil rather than trying to dig it in.
Okay.
And don't go crazy. I mean, there's no need to make it 2 feet high, the bed's 2 feet high, just 6 inches to a foot of real topsoil on top of what you've got will make all the difference in how those blackberries survive. And don't dig it in, just put it on the surface, run your beds parallel to the slope, perpendicular to the slope, if you see what I'm saying, so that they catch water as it moves downhill. Yeah, across the hill, Charlie says. He's giving me the simple term for it. Don't do it down, don't do it going upslope, downslope. You want it to go across the hill so that it catches the water. But that's what I would do. I would not dig in, or you're going to create bathtubs.
Okay. I thank you very much. I'll do that.
All right, Carol. Hey, if you run into more problems, you call me back and fuss at me and tell me I didn't figure this thing out right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye. Hey, we're going to be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Yeah. Rusty in Moss Point, be careful, buddy. So he picked some of this sumac. There's a bunch of different types of sumacs in the South. There's winged sumac, and there may be many versions of winged sumac It's very easy to figure that one out, and I'll tell you how. There's smooth sumac, glabra, and it becomes more tree-like. It has these beautiful bright pink stems. It's really kind of cool looking. And there's Rhus aromatica, which I like a lot. It looks like poison ivy, sort of, but it's not at all. It's a great spice. It's great for cooking with, it has a great odor. Aromatica, you can imagine. Aroma, Rhus aromatica, really great little plant. What is the common name for Rhus aromatica? I'll think of it in a minute. Maybe they just called aromatic sumac. Smelly sumac, they call it. And then there's the other sumac that we're going to call poison sumac. Poison sumac is actually a little more closely related to poison ivy than it is to the other sumacs. They're all closely related. But the other sumacs that I've described, up until the point we got to start talking about poison sumac, they're not poison at all. They're all good for you. In fact, in the Middle East, one of the great, if you've ever had Middle Eastern cuisine, one of the great spices that is used in that Middle Eastern cuisine is the spice from a Rhus species there, from a sumac species there that's very similar to ours. And so there's all those, but then there's this poison sumac. And it is not common. It is not common. And it's almost inevitably associated with wetlands here in the Southeast. It is, and it's not common even in wetlands. I've seen it in a few places. I learned to avoid it. It's actually a beautiful plant. It has really colorful stems, really beautiful. And Rusty, because you live near I know where you kind of live over there around Moss Point, and I know you spend a lot of time along the river and along the bayous, and there's a possibility you could run into poison sumac. I can tell you, Rusty, you sent me a picture, and because this is of an immediate concern, I'm going to tell you that the picture of the leaf on the left that is a darker green that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 leaves, the one with 9 leaves is clearly, unmistakably, without a doubt, winged sumac. Very safe, great to eat. Let me tell you about how to make lemonade from it. And you can tell it's a winged sumac, not only because it has fewer leaves, but also because between each of those leaves, actually what you're looking at are leaflets, because the whole thing that you picked is a leaf with 9 leaflets. It looks like there's a little swelling, a little wing on either side of the stem. You see that, Rusty? That's winged sumac, and you know that one's safe. You know you're okay with that one. Anytime you see that one, you think, oh, man, I ain't got to worry about that one. The one on the right is probably, what do they call it? Tree sumac it's glabra. Smooth sumac is one name. It's probably glabra. It looks to me like glabra. So it's probably safe too. I'm going to think about it just to make sure it's not a poison sumac. It doesn't have those little wings. It has more leaves. I think that's smooth sumac, and it's a cool smooth sumac too, and it's not toxic. But I'm just telling you, be careful, buddy. Don't pick any more leaves. I'm going to think about them just to make absolutely sure we got the right thing before I tell you to go out and mess with that plant again. You can always feel free to mess with winged sumac. It's not a problem at all. Chuck, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, sir. I called in a couple of years ago. I was the one that my wife dyed cotton and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I got a problem with deer, actually it's my neighbors that are creating the problem, but they ate up my kiwi, which heretofore has been, all I had to worry about was birds on that, but all the neighbors are feeding deer, and I live in an area that, I got a BB gun, but that doesn't do
that doesn't
good.
Do much,
I
does it? Yeah.
40 in my yard the other day, and they're eating up everything that I've got. satsumas and everything.
Oh, man.
Is there anything that I can do? Because I can't do anything other than the BB gun. Do you know, I've tried all the remedies, pie pans and tying them up. Is there something that will deter deer that I could put in the yard?
You know, everybody sells something that's supposed to deter deer.
Doesn't, and
apparently it doesn't. One of the things that, but here's there are two things that can be fairly effective. It's a big problem when people are feeding the deer. I don't know that any of this works when people feed the deer because they basically lose any fear of humans, or I mean, it becomes impossible to deal with. And not only that, maybe you can tell the people that by feeding the deer, they're encouraging wasting disease. Of course, the problem is
that,
hunters are doing it too, so it's not like you can really make a dent in it. But so there are two things that I've seen that are effective. Electric fence.
I've done that around what I really want to say. The solar part of electric fences. And now that works, but I can't do it in my whole place. I've got like 2-acre yard, and I was going to do it all the way around, and the neighborhood said I had to take it down. So that's mixed. I just can do it around little things.
So, you know, in 2 acres, the other thing are dogs. You know, it.
I can't have, you gotta. It's a leash law. You can't let one stay in the yard. So.
Yeah. So my dad would put the doghouse out by the garden, and he had a howling old English hound, and of course, anytime a deer came, he tied her up by the house. The little doghouse next to the garden at night. And anytime that deer would howl, every dog within 3 miles would come. And the deer would leave. Was very effective.
That's out of the question.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter. I got another thing, though, this is really interesting. Behind, I live in a bog. I don't know if it's a pitcher bog. I haven't seen any plants, but I live right at the mouth of Wolf Bay.
Right.
The very tip where all three creeks run together.
Right.
And anyhow, over at Graham Creek, which is across from us, they introduced indigo snakes, and I've got one. And I'm trying to get the neighbors not to run over it if it crosses the road, because we've got several where the high ground goes up, gopher tortoises behind my house on somebody else's property.
Yeah.
And that's cool as it can be. I guess it must have swam across from Graham Creek, but I actually have an indigo snake, and it's getting too tame.
Scared away. Without scaring it too far, I don't know why they would have done it there, because it is getting awful developed. Probably not the best place to enter.
Well, Graham Creek is 160 acres, and I don't know why it had to have come from there, you know, because they have a huge amount. It's a pitcher bog. It's a park, and they've got gopher tortoises all over the place.
Yeah, the home range of I can't remember what the home range of a indigo is, but it's something like a couple or 3 miles. So you actually need a really large area to support them. And I would say anything less than 5,000 acres of unbroken forest, unbroken longleaf.
That's what I thought too. Some place in Georgia, they had a big deal about introducing.
And that's probably not the best place to do it. I remember those pitcher plant bogs, and I remember what it was like there. And I remember how they were systematically drained, but it was
Yeah, we shouldn't. The houses shouldn't be built where I live. But it was dry when I bought it, and I didn't even know.
Yeah, that's right. It's something. Well, listen, Chuck, I got to take a break, or Charlie's going to get upset with me.
Well, go ahead.
Right, and but if I hear of anything else about the deer, you know, it gets tough. You know, I don't know which is worse, the neighborhood or the neighborhood codes or the deer. Between the two, you're kind of in a fix.
I know.
But I'll think about it.
Okay.
All right.
Bye now.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast sunny morning with Plain Gardening. I'm looking at all the details I can find. Rusty is set to figure out how do I make sure that you're not fiddling with poison sumac. We know that you got some winged sumac there. It looks like you got some smooth sumac as well. Probably you're okay. The color doesn't look quite right but I'm double checking. So let's work on it. Dan, nice to see your pickerel weed growing there in your pot. Kind of a fun thing to have. Dan's growing it in a water pot. A nice way to do it. Pete and I, we know cotton farmers in the Black Belt and other places in Alabama, and it is possible to do small agriculture, but it's getting harder and harder to do it. And one of the reasons it's hard to do agriculture, and it's not the small farms died because of government policy. There were other things driving it. But government policy accelerated the loss of small farms and thus the destruction of our rural communities. There were other things. You know, we tried to bring in industries and we picked the wrong industries. Being Mississippi and Alabama, we never really developed an educational base that moved us beyond textiles, and so textiles went to someplace cheaper to do that. So all those things happened. There are other things that happened in our rural areas, but agriculture was the base of these communities. Agriculture is why these communities existed. It's why people were there. But right now, the way we're doing agriculture and the way price supports work, it doesn't encourage small farms. It encourages consolidated farms, larger farms, which lower the prices theoretically up to a point of a lot of commodities, particularly commodities if you're going to produce ethanol. I mean, corn is now a big deal because of not because you're eating more corn. It's got nothing to do with feeding people. It has to do with feeding fuel stocks. Ethanol, and that means corn is subsidized twice, both because a huge amount of the price of corn is subsidized by the federal government. In addition, ethanol is mandated by federal law to be used, and the only way to produce ethanol is through corn. That means you're essentially supporting the price of corn two ways, by creating a product demand, and the federal government does both. And when you do that, you lower the price of corn, it becomes very hard for smaller farmers to compete, because unless they're growing specialty products. And so one of the interesting things, I think the future for smaller farmers lies in thinking about things besides commodities, things besides the big commodities. And we don't spend a lot of dollars encouraging that in Alabama. And that's one of the reasons why our rural areas continue to deteriorate. Drug use is huge. I mean, I don't know if you want to hear about this, but if you haven't been to some rural areas lately, drug use is just unbelievable, and the problems that exist in those areas. So I'd like to talk a little bit more when we come back about what I think are some solutions to those rural areas. And they sound a lot like some of the solutions to our gardening problems. We'll talk about it when we come back.
Me and my best friend Lillian in her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio plays.